Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. First off, a bit of admin. A few people got in touch with me after the last episode to let me know that the audio was a little quiet. I have asked my audio wizard hero, Jim Murray, to have a look at it, and he's made it substantially louder. I've re-uploaded it, so if you gave up on it last time, I'd recommend deleting it and re-downloading it, and hopefully it'll be more audible. Thank you everyone for your lovely comments about that episode. I was really pleased with how it came out, and I'd love to do more live events. If anyone can think of locations, topics, guests, or anything like that, please do get in touch. Now, this episode was recorded earlier this year when author Jenny Valentich was in the country. I read her book Woman of Substances with interest, and so we had a chat about it, the research she undertook that led her to realise how issues around dependence and addiction particularly impact on women, her own experiences with drugs and alcohol, as well as touching on the use of language, stigma, Alan Partridge impressions, you name it. So enjoy Jenny Valentich and I say why to women and drugs.
Say why to drugs with Dr. Susie Gage.
Okay, so this is another episode of Say Why to Drugs. I've started with the word so because that is something that I can't avoid, it seems. But I'm joined today by Jenny Valentich. So can I just get you to briefly introduce yourself? Or introduce yourself as long-windedly as you like.
I'll sort of go for halfway. My name's Jenny Valentich. I'm a journalist. I'm from England. I'm from Slough, but I live in Australia now. And I've written a book called Woman of Substances. And it's a gendered look at women and drugs and alcohol use. Over in Australia, I just tend to write for newspapers, but I really wanted to do something different and kind of exploit my power as a journalist to use myself as a case study and interview lots of interesting people to find out why I used to behave the way I did.
Brilliant. Well, so this isn't perhaps usual for this podcast. Quite often I speak to scientists and do you have a science background?
Not at all, which made me feel, you know, incredible imposter syndrome embarking on this book.
But so I've been reading the book, and one of the things that really struck me is how science-y it is. Really goes into quite a lot of depth. And what made you decide to sort of take that angle with this topic?
I quit drinking for 8 years, and immediately upon stopping, I sort of turned it into a bit of a project, really. It's how my mind works. You know, if there's any kind of adversity, project. So I, at that time, read as many books as I possibly could. And most of what I read were addiction memoirs. And I felt like what I was learning was very limited because they all had the same narrative. They all had this kind of exciting crescendo of gory details. And then you reach this rock bottom and then suddenly the tone dramatically changes and it becomes AA speak. Anyone who's ever been to AA or seen it on TV immediately recognises the phrases that they're suddenly using. And then it ends with redemption. But it didn't really teach me anything about why did I keep doing the stupid things I kept doing? Why was I so impulsive? Why do you make the same mistakes over and over and over again despite knowing how things are going to wind up? So they're the kind of things that I wanted to know. And of course, I had to talk to people. I couldn't just write about how bad things got for me. I needed to talk to people who had the answers. So I stitched together the expertise of about 35 different neuroscientists and researchers and clinicians to put together this bigger picture. And I think, from what I can tell, it's been really useful even to people who work in the field, because I think you can get kind of tunnel vision a little bit and sort of become such a specialist in your own area that it's quite good to see what everyone else is doing under that same theme of women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've learned a lot from reading it, definitely. And it's something that it has struck me, but only fairly recently, that there is this actual sort of importance of thinking about women specifically when talking about drug use, addiction, dependence, sort of whatever kind of labels you want to put on it. There are issues that are quite specific to women, or not even necessarily that, but that women might be sometimes slightly kind of overlooked in terms of who the research is focused on, who's doing the research, all of these kind of things. And that's something that I sort of got out from your book, so I wanted to ask you a bit more about that, really.
Yeah, because when I started writing it, I was doing it from the female perspective, purely because I'm female. But the more I talked to people and the more I learned about research into drug and alcohol issues and also the treatment industry, the more it became kind of politicised, because I realised actually, first of all, drug and alcohol use is way more gendered than I realised, whether it be your pathways into problematic use, the sort of behaviour or things that happen to you when you're in the throes of it, and your pathways into treatment. It's really, really gendered, so I hadn't realised that. So it kind of became a call to arms in the end. In fact, there is a chapter called A Call to Arms.
And what are some of the issues? So thinking about, let's pick, like getting into drug use, or more perhaps going from drug use to problematic drug use.
Mm.
What are some of the issues that sort of struck you when you were researching the book?
There's a chapter called A Crude Form of Seduction, and that's about how girls initially sort of get into drugs. And I thought it was going to be mainly awful stories of coercion and predators, and there definitely is that aspect as well, although it tends to be anecdotal because there isn't much in the way of research about it, whether that's because research tends to be male biased or it's just hard to get people to talk about their stories, I don't know. But I also found that often actually girls get into drug use through older men because they see older men as a broker.
Mm.
And that was actually the case for me. Who's got the drugs? Older blokes. Whether you're at school and you're a 13-year-old wanting to get some pot, and it's, you know, it's got to be the boy 2 years above, or whether it's something more serious when you're a little bit older. I think a lot of girls are actually proactive in seeking out men and sometimes dealers to play that role. But the problem is, of course, then there's a power imbalance, and you're very much without any currency as a young girl, particularly if you're getting drugs for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and one of the other things that you've mentioned is that women or girls will quite often start to use substances before boys. And what sort of impact can that have on them?
They often tend to use drugs and alcohol before boys if they are quite impulsive, because boys and girls express impulsivity in different ways, and so it often gets missed in girls actually. So in boys, you know, you might have more kind of showboating behaviour, like getting into fights or train surfing or something like that, whereas girls tend to have behaviours that are a bit more kind of stealthy,
mm-hmm.
because you're conditioned to be quieter. So impulsivity can express itself through early substance use and also things like theft,
yeah,
and fraud and high-risk sex. Those behaviours tend to have a lot of stigma attached to them. I mean, especially substance use, you know, it's seen as very unfeminine. So the older you get, the more sort of unacceptable it becomes. I remember, in my case, definitely sort of towards the end when I was about 34, my friend and I, my sort of best drinking buddy, we'd be sat at the bar and We were like that pair in The Simpsons, Selma and Patty.
Oh, yeah.
we were worried that we were coming across as really sort of pathetic and like a pair of pathetic old crones. And it
God,
just seemed
I'm
to get...
now.
I think it was just because we were at a bar all the time.
Mm.
And we were of that age where you're starting to get less fertile. And I think that, in our minds, sort of made it more unacceptable publicly.
I guess as more and more of your friends or peers or cohort or whatever you want
yeah,
to call
start
it, they
peeling off.
Drift away,
yeah.
They've got families. And
bloody lightweights.
Yeah.
And then it's just you two, and then I quit, and then it was just her, and that was awkward.
yeah, so in terms of then girls starting to use first, I think there's also sort of neuro potential risks from that as well, like... I work in the cannabis field mostly, mm-hmm. and there's a lot talked about using substances during adolescence being more problematic than sort of waiting until you're in your early to mid-20s when your brain is fully developed
yeah.
and that kind of thing. But I think there's also a lot of social issues around early substance use as well.
There is a study in the book, it was a neuroscientist called Susan Tappert, and she was looking at the white matter in the brain and what happens when adolescents start drinking very heavily. And actually, they had different results in boys and girls. I think the girls were... they had more problems with spatial awareness.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think boys, it made them a bit more impulsive, but girls were more forgetful and... had this spatial problem. So it's strange, isn't it? When you look at the biological differences between men and women in terms of being affected by drugs and alcohol, they're actually quite different, and women have a much broader spectrum of things as well.
Yeah, and this is something that I think is becoming more and more noticed now, is that actually a lot of the research is quite often man as the default and then woman as kind of other.
Yeah.
Or sometimes not even looked at all. Like, so... as I say, I work in the cannabis field,
yeah.
and cannabis and psychosis was a particular area of interest to me. And the first massive study that found an association between cannabis and psychosis was all in Swedish conscripts. So it was all in men.
Yeah.
And it's kind of wasn't even, it was like, oh, well, it's a limitation that it's only men. But, you know, still, we found this thing, and let's sort of just move on. And...
yeah, because a lot of people at the top of the research game are male, and so that trickles down. Quite a few female researchers who I talked to when writing this book told me, both on and off the record, that they'd been actively discouraged from looking at women specifically, as if men are the norm, and men aren't really the norm in addiction, particularly in terms of drinking. Women are actually overtaking men. And in any case, you can't extrapolate the data from men and apply it to women because we're completely biologically different.
Yeah.
And, you know, we also have different stresses and psychological issues as well.
Yeah, and pressures on us sort of culturally and societally and that sort of thing.
So we've got this problem of the treatment industry still very much being geared towards the male experience as well, which... I know a big rallying cry is always that we need more trauma-focused care, which of course also benefits men, but we also need gender-sensitive care. We need to look at the fact that a lot of women will have experienced domestic violence or have very little autonomy, and these are major things that would need to be addressed.
Yeah, and obviously for the most part, people who use substances don't have problems with them, but for the people who do develop problems, there's quite often other factors at play, and those factors won't be the same for men and women.
Mm.
And for women, as you say, trauma may well be a huge part of that.
Very likely, yeah. And another issue there is if you choose the 12-step route, then that's something that was again designed for men. And if you're in a mixed group and already feeling very vulnerable because you just quit something, you're then expected to sort of further make yourself vulnerable and share about your backstory. And to me, personally, that felt really unsafe. I don't mean literally unsafe, but like on
making
a cellular
sort of
kind of level.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It just wasn't what I wanted to be doing at all.
So the 12-step plan, that's kind of the basis of it, is sort of turning yourself over to a higher power. Is that
yes.
right?
Yeah, so the idea is that you haven't done a great job of looking after yourself till this point. This is how it was put to me. I went for 18 months. You haven't done a great job at sorting out your life and managing your addictions, so you're going to hand it over to this higher power, which is usually called a god of your own description. Some people say it's the universe or it's the power in the rooms. But whatever it is, the idea is that you're not making many decisions for yourself. And that's underlined by things like people saying, don't do anything dramatic in the first year, don't get in a relationship. So very much the whole ethos is of giving your power away. And there's a common argument that's not good for women who quite possibly haven't had much power in their lives or autonomy over their lives. And actually, they need to be learning to be empowered.
In that case, then, sort of, is there much research into gender treatment going on at the moment? Did you find much when you were doing your research? Or what did you find worked best for you?
I had the approach of basically trying a bit of everything. So, as I said earlier, I read as much as I could. I also went to AA for 18 months. And I also went to an outpatient service, which was all about, you know, CBT and motivational interviewing and mindfulness and that kind of thing, and just absorbed as many different tools as I could. But ultimately, after 18 months, I went it alone, and I just really forensically looked at all the areas of my life or my behaviour which hadn't been working for me, and thought about why they weren't working for me and tried to tweak those things. I actually did it in the form of a blog, which was called Hey Man, Now You're Really Living, which was named after an Eels song. And the premise was I was just doing something I'd never done before every day for a year. But really the underlying thing was trying to find things that I might enjoy doing and challenge myself in areas where I was quite weak, like being fearful of people, you know. So by doing this blog where I had to approach people and do something new every day for a year, it really put me out of my comfort zone. And I'd definitely been guilty during the sort of drinking and drug taking years of following the path of least resistance. So yeah, my getting better plan was really a bit of everything. And these days, I drink these days, but I do go to smart recovery meetings. And in Australia, because we've got a harm minimization strategy, smart recovery meetings, it's perfectly acceptable to be going and sort of moderating your use. So I do that, and I see an addiction-based psychologist.
What's SMART?
So SMART started in 96. I'm going to try not to sound like I'm giving you a spiel, because I'm actually on the board. I'm on the board in Australia now.
Sorry, as long as you declare everything,
yeah,
that's
absolutely
fine.
Yeah, on the board and above board. So SMART, it's across the world now, started in the States in 96. And basically, you're given tools to sort of empower your own treatment, I guess. And it's in a group setting, so it's free meetings. And you would spend the first part of the meeting looking at the previous 7 days and what were the challenges you had to face, what were the successes, and you'll kind of analyse that. You might talk on a bit of a theme, perhaps, in the middle of the meeting. And then at the end, you look at the next 7 days and your challenges and goals. So it's really proactive. There's no war stories, which I really liked about it. And it's people often just take it as needed. So, you know, they might go for a period, stop, maybe go for another period.
And is it mixed or is it?
Yeah, it's mixed gender. I think sometimes you can get women only. There are definitely queer groups, but yeah, the vast majority is mixed gender.
One thing I wanted to ask you, as someone who's sort of not a scientist but has written a really sort of thoughtful science book, is how easy or difficult was it to kind of navigate this research topic? Because it is an area where there is quite a lot of disagreement potentially between researchers. So how did you find that?
I was really worried about that because I do not come from an academic background, really, but I assumed that for every researcher, there's going to be their nemesis, or at least, you know, it could be a few, at least one. Mm. So I thought, God, I'm going into this blind. I could interview someone that could give me the best information in the world, but then what if in the media or on Twitter or something, their nemesis pops up and goes, that's rubbish, That didn't happen. but I was in a position where I literally started this book, I probably shouldn't admit it, by doing things like Googling professor comorbid eating disorders. And
well, you've got to start somewhere. Yeah. I mean,
and then for each person I interviewed would recommend other people.
Yeah.
And so it was this kind of rolling ball. And so I think I've got a pretty good sort of idea of who's out there now. But it was a bit like, am I stitching together a Frankenstein's monster? Because everyone I speak to, it's making perfect sense. But I'm creating this bigger picture without having spent years and years working in the field.
Yeah, but, well, I'm all for the kind of democratization of science anyway, and that you don't have to have a qualification to be able to use the scientific method of kind of critical thinking and sort of exploring the evidence.
And it's been really well received by the people that I've interviewed and people beyond them. Like, it's been, I've heard nothing but positive comments, and it's made it onto a few university courses. And I know that certain chapters are being photocopied and handed out to clients. So I'm really chuffed at that. That to me means I did what I set out to do.
Do you think there are sort of take-home messages, maybe isn't quite the right word, but given that there are these kind of real gendered issues and that potentially women are kind of underrepresented in the literature and underrepresented in treatments and anything, What should researchers be focusing on? Are there specific areas you noticed where there were kind of big gaps? Like maybe around treatment specific or that kind of thing, or anything else that you noticed?
Yeah, the thing I think is most vital is the fact that women often have a comorbid eating disorder and substance use. And these people who have both those things severely can really fall between the cracks and potentially die. Because very few detoxes or rehabs, especially government-funded ones, want to take on somebody who's got a severe eating disorder. They're not trained, and they possibly don't even have the medical equipment. I mean, they probably don't. They're not going to have feeding tubes. And the other flip side of that is eating disorder places, units, won't take somebody who's affected by drugs. So it's a catch-22. You're in this no-man's land, and that's a real problem. I think in the States, you get some really, really super expensive private rehabs that will cover both things. But, you know, in terms of the public health system, we don't really have places that can cover that. And I think that needs to be the priority.
I think that's true of quite a lot of other comorbidities with substance use as well. Mm. I think substance use and mental health aren't treated particularly well as a duo, but there's probably been more focus on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most people would probably qualify for a dual diagnosis, and you often can get bounced around then between services. I think at the very least, though, you know, if you go and see a drug and alcohol service, they're going to have a pretty good idea of what bipolar disorder looks like, or, you know, whatever it is.
Should, like, the government or healthcare services or that kind of thing be doing more to kind of address this imbalance? Just the difference in problems for men versus women?
Yeah, I don't really see it being talked about that much, which, you know, became the point of this book, really. We're definitely seeing women still as mini men. If anything, I think the attitude now is just that, oh yes, women take drugs too, but it hasn't stretched as far as, do you think their needs might be different?
Perhaps there's something in it. And women themselves, do you think there's anything like that women need to be mindful of when thinking about using substances or that kind of thing? One of the things that struck me recently is with lots of talk about MDMA strength going up and that kind of thing, and thinking about what a dose of MDMA is and how just sort of physically and biologically women absorb drugs differently to men and that kind of thing, and that if you just hear one, this dose is this, it's almost certainly a male dose.
And I forget what the official term is, but water intoxication actually affects women more than men, because of some biological anomaly that I can't remember. But basically, so if you took a pill, say, and then you were overhydrating and you're a woman, you're more at risk of water intoxication. There are so many ways in which we're more at risk of taking drugs and alcohol, and it's not just because we're possibly smaller or the factor muscle ratio is different. There's also things like the amount of enzymes in the stomach that break things down.
And where we are on our menstrual cycles as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So this was really interesting to find out. I mean, probably most women would notice that if they've got their period, it's not a great time to be going out and getting wasted because
it's not a great time to do anything.
It's not a great time to do anything. But you probably have noticed that you're more likely to sort of crash at the bar on that week. But what I didn't know was every other week of your cycle, depending on whether you're sort of flooded with progesterone or estrogen, you're becoming more attracted or less attracted to drugs, and also they're having more or less of an effect on you. And I'm pretty sure most women aren't aware of that. That took some real spelunking into research papers to find that out.
No, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, in a way it makes sense, but yeah, I don't think it's something that you'd particularly notice. And it's probably not a dramatic difference, but even...
I don't know. I mean, I think it can be dramatic, actually. So I think particularly around ovulation points, things you might notice are that you tend to smoke a lot more. You might masturbate more. And so, yes, you're also very likely to be sort of more impulsively drinking and taking drugs, and your system is more sensitized to them. So I have read.
That is very, very interesting. See, this is where I start thinking, research ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that I was particularly interested when I was reading your book was about this phenomenon of telescoping, which I only just learnt about myself.
Yeah.
Which is the idea that although women might be less likely to go and seek treatment, they tend to, or it looks like they tend to progress to more serious problems more quickly and struggle to then get better.
I think most clinicians would tell you that women progress faster than men when it comes to getting dependent. But one person I interviewed who works in the sort of A&E department of a hospital said actually that's a bit of a myth in her opinion, and it's just that women have so many barriers to treatment that they can't access it as early as men, so that by the time they do access it,
they're already on that.
Yeah,
and I think that makes sense why it looks like they might actually have poorer prognoses, but actually it's because they're a different population, because they're the more severe end, because they've already got to that.
And it could be both. It could be a bit of both. Given that we have already acknowledged the fact in our chat that, you know, drugs affect women differently, it probably is that they are proceeding quicker, but also they're not able to access services so quickly.
So it's a complex picture.
It is a complex picture.
In lots of these cases. I think what you say about sort of barriers to treatment there is really important as well, that there are all sorts of reasons why women might wait longer to seek treatment. Mm-hmm. There's sort of issues of stigma, there's issues of potentially not sort of being able to because of the situation that they're in their lives. Are there other reasons, do you think?
Often it is a childcare issue, particularly if you're a single mum, but also even if you're in a stable relationship. Anecdotally, I've heard a lot that the male partner would be quite reluctant to encourage the female to seek treatment because that's going to saddle him with, you know, the childcare duties as well as whatever else he's got on. So there's definitely, you know, if you're the glue of the family, then you've got more responsibility, and it definitely would be more difficult to say, right, I'm just going to go for a month. Not to mention the fact that depending what culture you're from, it could be incredibly frowned upon for you to be a woman who's been taking drugs or drinking. And you've also got to admit that, or at least have people think that you've possibly been unsafe around the kids.
Yeah, I was going to say there must be then the whole issue of sort of the fear of kind of state intervention
as
well.
And I think that's a bigger problem here in the UK, I understand, than it is in Australia, I think, because there have been some really awful cases of neglect, which the tabloids leapt upon. And, you know, social services were being blamed and other kind of sectors were being blamed. Things are a bit more heavy-handed now. So if a woman sticks up her hand and goes, tries to get help, there is a risk that she'll have her kids taken away. Whereas in Australia, it's more collaborative, and a drug and alcohol service will really work with a mum to try and prevent that from happening, because they want to say to you, well done for coming for help.
Because if you haven't, trying to sort it out. Yeah. Absolutely. We've kind of focused on the very severe end of drug use, where it becomes problematic use. You might need to seek treatment. You've sort of got dependence or addiction, and it's sort of depending on the kind of language that we want to use. But that's not going to be the case for most people who use substances.
Yeah.
But there are also important sort of issues about just how drug use is perceived differently between men and women, or for men and women to use drugs.
Yeah.
That I think is interesting to kind of touch on as well.
Yeah, I think with women, it's almost always pathologized. So with men, it's more seen as a rite of passage, getting wasted with the lads. But in reality, for men, it might be actually self-medicating and stress and whatever. And the reverse is true with women, where it's best to be seen as mad or sad than bad. Mm-hmm. So it dates back, God, probably to Freud's day, but or beyond. But particularly if you look at things like women's magazines in the 1950s onwards, you'd get all these adverts from pharmaceutical companies for things like Ritalin and various sedatives. And the photo would invariably be of a housewife kind of having a nervous breakdown, you know, hemmed in by vacuum cleaners and screaming kids. And basically the tagline would be something like, you can't free her, but you can make her feel better. So there's been this long pathway history of women being framed as pathologically anxious, and certainly, you know, there is an anxiety around not having a fulfilling life. But yeah. I think now, if you bring it up to the modern day, you've got all these wine o'clock memes. You know, I guess they're fun. They've usually got, again, somebody having a bit of a nervous breakdown, perhaps a Victorian lady or something. But it's still framing
as drinking to cope.
To cope. And sometimes it might be, but sometimes, be frank, you might just be having a drink because you fancy one, or you're bored. But it's like women have got to frame their use as being a woman's lot.
Yeah.
And men have got to frame it as, this is great fun.
Yeah, but actually we're probably not as different as you might think. And there's probably both reasons for men and both reasons for women.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, just before we wrap up, before we started recording, I asked you if there's anything specifically that you were keen to talk about, and you said language, and it's something that I am really interested in as well. So
I'll take it from here.
So, yeah. Well, I was going to just list a load of words, and then I realised it sounded really like Alan Partridge, so I resisted.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, no, I mean, addiction, dependence, I'm not going to do it. It's awful,
yeah.
But what did you mean by that when you said it's language?
I get really cranky by the language of absolutes. So addict, alcoholic, and then things like disease and, you know. Reason being, it's saying, obviously it trickles down from the 12-step paradigm, first of all. But the reason I have an issue with it is it's basically saying that anyone who ever puts their hand up for help with their drug and alcohol use is now automatically an addict or an alcoholic. It completely disregards A, levels of dependence, and psychological stroke physical dependence, which are two different things. But it also disregards, you know, the biopsychosocial approach. Mm-hmm. So it disregards the fact that maybe you were drinking chaotically because you've got unresolved trauma, or maybe it's because you're self-medicating anxiety. Instead, you're just an addict or an alcoholic. And I just think that's so unhelpful apart from the fact that it's they're unclinical terms anyway, that, you know, they're not official terms.
Yeah. I mean, people who've listened to this podcast before will know that I agree with that. And it's really limiting as well. It's sort of defining, whereas a person is so much more than that.
But I do get that some people really want to call themselves those things because it's their way of remembering what things were like before. It's ownership. It ties you in with a community of other people who have that sort of background. And that's fine, you know, if you want those labels for yourself. But I get really frustrated when I see it in the media or people applying it to others.
Well, I think that is a good place to finish.
Great.
So thank you so, so much for speaking to me today. And your book, Woman of Substances, is available in all good bookshops.
Yeah,
and
or online.
Other bookshops as well. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And there we go. If you're worried about your own substance use, I've added some of the links that Jenny and I talk about. These are mostly UK relevant, but if you're based elsewhere and are looking for support and can't find it, please do message me and I'll see what I can do finding links in your area. I hope you all have a lovely festive time wherever you are and whatever you're doing. I'll mainly be writing my book, if I'm honest. Check out on Amazon, already for pre-sale. Terrifying. But I'm quite looking forward to spending the festive period doing that. And I'll be back with new episodes in the new year as well. But for now, bye! You've been listening to Say Why to Drugs with me, Dr. Susie Gage. The music was by Jim Murray, the artwork was by @MyNameIsAd. Say Why to Drugs would not have been possible without the generous support of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, the Medical Research Council, and Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.